I mean, I just watch this thing and I'm always going, it's Hannah. I'm like, I'm screaming it like from season three. I'm like, it's Hannah. What's wrong with you people? It's obviously fucking Hannah. And
welcome back to Word of the Witnesses, our 12 Monkeys rewatch podcast. In this case, rewatch means we've seen the whole thing from the beginning to the end and back again. We spoil early, often, and always. Now, you are almost to the end, but please, please, please watch 409 in the finale before you listen to this. This is Beep, and you're about to hear Cece and I speak with some very important people about the episode 1 minute more.
Welcome back. We're so excited to have Brooke Williams, who plays our beloved Hannah, Terry Metalis, showrunner and co-creator, and writer-producer Christopher Monfette to discuss 1 minute more. I think everybody knows why that just took a second to say. Did you have any initial thoughts after rewatching?
I mean, I always have thoughts because it's almost like a home movie. You know, you remember all the things that was either going on set or in prep, or a lot of posts. This one was a lot of posts for me. But I think, Chris, you were on set for more of this than I think I was. And certainly, Brooke, you were there for the most important parts.
So. I mean, every time I see this episode, and it's one that I think is among our best and I'm hugely proud of. I'm always just sort of mindful of what an absolute clusterfuck it was to make and wrestle into shape at every level. I mean, it was just, it was such an interesting episode because we all knew how important it was going to be. And we knew that it needed to work not just well, but like almost expertly and perfectly. That literally from like the day we first started thinking about, and Kristen and I first started talking about what should the shape of this episode be? What should the emotional pace of it be? How should it lay out? How should you turn the cards all the way through production, all the way through, you know, looking at the first cut of it and then sort of watching Terry and I think it was Drew, wrestle it into shape. The amount of effort that went into the end results on this one was massive and not always in a fun, breezy way. It pushed back a lot and it was a challenge and one that I think we ultimately kind of conquered well.
Yeah.
What was most challenging about it?
Everything.
Oh, everything.
Everything. I think so. In no particular order, it was the last one to be shot before the finale. So most of the important personnel on the show were concentrating on this 2-hour finale we were going to do, which I was directing and I was in prep for. So it had kind of the least amount of resources. And, you know, in the finale was also a Herculean effort as well, and had many, many minds looking at it, making sure we were buttoning up every little thing with emotional dialogue to how are we going to do a raid on Titan. So you had everybody was working crazy hours and, you know, just the emotion. This is Brooke's last episode and the biggest and one of the biggest payoffs of mythology, which I was paused. I mean, I just watched this thing and I'm always going, it's Hannah. I'm like, I'm screaming it like from season three. I'm like, it's Hannah. What's wrong with you people? It's obviously fucking Hannah. And it's funny. One of my best friends from high school just finally sat down to watch it all. Also, he didn't see it coming. And I'm like, so we tried. I also didn't mind if you did see it coming as long as it was satisfying. But it was a lot of work. To hide the Marion Woods thing. And I mean, it is schmuck baity and like in the best ways. I'll get into the post of it all later, but this one, because it was once we shot it, then we went and shot the finale which was gigantic. And then we went to Comic-Con. We all got on a plane and went to Comic-Con, and then we went to Prague for another month. So I didn't even see the cut of this like until 3 months after it shot, and we had wrapped and everything was bulldozed. And Chris will tell you, I thought we ruined the show in the first cut, which is fine. It's typically happens. And as Drew, I think Drew's going to come on for the finale. You know, it's just, that's what happened. Rarely does a first cut just is absolutely perfect and magical. It only happened really once for us. And that was 212 Blood Washed Away was kind of just like a perfect cut where I was like, oh my God, I was just sitting back and enjoying it. And I didn't have to do anything. This one was much harder just because of the emotional stakes. I will say the one thing that always worked was Hannah's letter at the end, which I think Chris played a big part in writing. That montage always worked, which was, so I knew we had like a beacon of light. Like if we could get to that montage, it was, you know, perfectly, everything was really well done about it, from Brooke's final performance to the direction to the words, and even the temp score was like so set up for Steven to knock it out of the park. So if we could get to that, but all the other stuff, the puzzle pieces also had to come together too. So it wasn't just a surprise that Hannah is Cole's mom. It's also a surprise that Cole is the demon, and that has to land really hard, or else the finale doesn't work. And that's another thing where you got to be like, I'm going, it's Cole. It's obviously Cole. Anyway, I'll stop rambling, and because I think everybody really wants to hear from Brooke about this, but this is really hard. I still look at it and go, we should have picked up an extra shot here or there. There's one shot that we complete layers. You really want to get behind the scenes. There's a shot of Brooke in the airport that's not really Brooke in the airport. It's like Brooke, we cut her out of another scene and put her into a background just to set up a presence. So because originally she just sort of came out of nowhere and took the bullet for Cole, so we kind of had to set up that she was there. So we had to put that together. You know, these are all the things. And by the way, every Marvel movie, every Star Wars movie is doing all these things too. But yeah, that's it. That's all I have.
What order did you guys film this in? I know you said before the finale, but you had season four kind of out of order in general. Do you know where this landed between?
Yeah, it landed right before the finale. The only thing we did was we shot it all in order, but all the scenes that were in Prague, we held. So that would be Jennifer Goines in her spy stuff, the stuff with, Varys, all that stuff. And then we did the Nazis, and then we did the Middle Ages. So there was quite a bit still to do. It was like a month, 5 weeks of shooting in Prague left to do. That was pretty serious. But emotionally, this was going to be goodbye to our Toronto crew and our sets, and basically our home for the last 4 years. So it was like a double. It was not healthy. It's not healthy. So we were like, we said goodbye to everybody, and then we wrapped the show. Then we did Comic-Con, so you have this other euphoria. It's like, yay, we're still a thing. And then you go to Prague, and it was just this, you know, downward spiral of emotions for 5 weeks.
I remember getting caught up in the whirlwind of that, because I have this distinct memory of, you know, you're going, and you're writing, and you're turning the pages, and you're running the set to produce this scene for this episode, blah, blah, blah. And it finally got to, I guess, what wasn't our last day, but it was my last day. It was the last day that I was going to be there. I was so hyped up and so in, you know, just in the speed of it all, that I remember getting on the transpo van to go back to the hotel. And someone actually had to say out loud, because I was so tired and so amped up, you're never going to see this place again, huh? And I had completely, sort of as it faded into the background, missed my opportunity to say goodbye to that set and those people, because I just assumed that I was going to be there the next day because it had become such a part of my life. So this episode in a lot of ways feels like a, you know, obviously a goodbye to Hannah and a setup for the finale. But for me, it kind of felt the same way as well.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to hear how you know, really sounds like you all were wrestling with a lot of different things, both, you know, emotional and in production and post-production. And was it, hopefully it was gratifying when you sort of absorbed the audience reaction, because people, you can still, like, even for people who have watched it 2 years ago, just absolutely devastated. but it's also beloved. So, I mean, people even say sort of like the title of the episode, this kind of reverence. And so what I think is so interesting is that at Terry, as you were saying, but there's three mythology, huge questions that you answer, because it's not only that Cole's the demon, it's not only that Hannah's his mom, but it's that they started the plague, which is just
and
like...
And they started the plague.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which was, we had built the season just as, I think I might have mentioned this before, but originally at the end of season three, Ethan told Cassie that he warned her. He said, I need you, right before he gave her the watch, before she ran out of Titan, he said to her, and we shot it. He said, I need you to know that in every timeline I've ever seen in my head, it was you who started the plague. And she was like, bombshell, all fucked up. And the problem was, we had a situation where going into season four, everybody started to have too many secrets, and that was the biggest, and it kind of like broke. It was like, it was not easy to have Cassie know that and not tell anybody that, specifically not Cole, because once you know that, you'd be like, well, let's go back and figure out why we would do, like, it's just too big a clue. So we just cut it from the scene but it was something we had always known. I think in season one, it was one of the original ideas, was they have to start this so that time travel can be invented, because that's both the tool and the method of destruction and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I mean, for as busy an episode as this is, it also takes so many character beats and lets us really sit with some, you know, there's a lot emotionally to process in this episode. And Brooke, I mean, the biggest, obviously, with Hannah. And one of the things I was thinking about, the last time you were on, we talked about how in Daughters, you had to play sort of Hannah as sort of in this fish out of water story. And in this episode, you're playing the same character, but over different, you know, basically the course of 9 years and significant events in her life, which are a mystery to the audience until the end. So how did you approach sort of how you're going to manifest those differences in your performance?
I think, you know, there's such a big change for Hannah because her purpose is so clear now, and it wasn't before. And so even though she's had what I consider to be a really sad and heartbreaking time, it's for something. And I think she's such a purpose-driven human, and she will sacrifice for the greater good. She's always been that way, and now she knows what that means. And, you know, I don't have any kids, and so, like, I was really having to use my imagination to kind of create what that would be like to have to make that sacrifice that she has to make, and the heartbreak that would be. And, you know, I think if you don't have a child, it's very hard to imagine, and so I really did a lot of kind of creating for myself around that. And I think what I wanted to do with her in this episode is to create a more settled version of her, that she did a calmness even in all the chaos. She knows what she's connected to now and her reason, and her ultimate reason, and it's all been for something. And I know for myself, like, when I feel heartbroken, I the same thing always happens. I had it happen really badly one time where I completely lost my voice. Like, my voice just went for about 3 weeks. And so I was thinking about her, and I was thinking about what the weight of that grief would do. And I just wanted to have a slight change in her voice. And I don't even know really if it translates, but that was what was in my head, that the weight of this has been in her throat. And yeah, you see her in Daughters, and it's this kind of erratic, scattered energy. And, you know, she's between these worlds. But I think she's, by this episode, she's found her place, and she's really sitting in it, even though it's such an uncomfortable, sad thing to see from the outside.
Mm. I think you do hear it. I think you do hear it in your voice from the second you're in the hotel room. And then we added, some gray, which on Brooke, it's just so youthful. So the gray is just such an impact. You're like, oh my, wow, I'd never, ever thought she'd have a gray. And so it all worked really well. I mean, performance wise, it could not have gone better. I think you fall in love with Hannah a lot in this season. I mean, I think you always thought she was really cool in previous seasons, and you're like, oh, you're really interested. But I think it's really this season as it goes on that you really like. I think we did that right. Like, just at the moment that you love her the most, you find out she has the most impact on the mythology. And the other thing is Brooke, with that voice, like, she just has that her Hannah voice. You know, we joked the last time we were on, it really is this ethereal, like, you really want to listen. So when that letter comes and it's all sort of spelled out, it just adds to the execution of that. And there was a lot of doubt. I mean, there were fierce arguments in the writer's room about this idea that you could show her and Matthew Cole and there would be chemistry. And I was like, I think that Brooke can have chemistry with anyone. I mean, she has those eyes, and I think she's going to have to give you that performance that believes that she's in love, and that's going to, like, it's going to work. But there
that's
were
so interesting.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it was, yeah.
Sorry, can I?
No. It's fine. You can drop it. And so there, I won't say who, but it was doubt, I think, all the way until it aired from those parties. And then there was also, like, I remember nailing the script was also, as Chris was talking about, I mean, Chris, I remember the moment we came up with the very last scene, because the script basically was over. The story was basically over with Hannah tells the story, and then they're like, you're the demon. Like, that's it, Cole, you're the demon. Let's go into the finale. But what bummed me out about it was we never actually got to have a moment with the Jones family. So with the Cole family. So, like, we never had Cole, Hannah, and Jones. And I remember I was like, well, what if we just did one last scene where they go to her at the Emerson? I mean, it's just like this little tiny set corner of the set by a fireplace, and we give them their moment, and it's short, and they can just be together. And then just as you're soaking up the warmth of that family outside, the red storms begin, and they're like, they just have like just 1 minute more, which sort of like, I remember that moment was also a late, like, yeah, really late addition to the script. And so, anyway, one more story. I'm so sorry. So this is also just tooting our own horn. So we finished the script, and I was like, "Fuck, we did it!" Like, I believed that the script was going to work, which is, like Chris said, it was just a giant effort. And I get this call from the network, from Sci-Fi, and they're like, "We think it's really cool that Hannah is mom, but we just don't think it's going to land." And as right now, as you have it, I'm like, what do you mean? And at that point, for writers, when we all were very collaborative, so it would be me and Chris and Sean and Kristen and Oliver and everyone involved and the actors as well, you know, we're doing read throughs. You're really working out hard. So then to get a call from exactly like, I didn't really feel anything. You just want to go insane. You want to go crazy. Because you've worked so hard, but you have to listen to it because they're your partners. And it was the one moment where I remember I was at the set where it was like one of the sets for Titan, and I just stopped them mid sentence and I said, "This is going to work. Leave me alone. I promise you, you will feel something when this comes down." And they kind of didn't want to let me off the phone, and I was just like, I was like at the end of my rope on that, and I was like, no. It's going to work. I will die trying to make this work. And then there was post.
Is there a title to the episode before before this, before you guys added that last moment?
Oh, was there? I don't know, Chris. There must have been a different title.
No, there actually there. I don't think there was, because we had handed in the script to you, and that's when you and I started talking. And we decided we needed that last scene, and I actually remember, I for whatever reason have this vivid memory of exactly where I was sitting in the all writer's office in Toronto when I gave you that last scene, and we started talking about it, and you were like, "What should we call this thing?" And for whatever reason, I think I you and I looked at each other at the same time, and we're kind of like, "One minute more is
the last line of the thing." Yeah,
title fingers, yeah.
We were on set. Yeah. We were on the other soundstage with where the Emerson was in that little room. Yeah. I don't know. I think at once it was like how Hannah got her groove back.
What I think is so one of the things that when you go back and rewatch it, the title of the episode and sort of that moment when Cole says that to, you know, the two women he'll later call his two mothers, is that on the one hand, it's something that I feel like we all say offhand all the time, right? Like, give me one more minute, like one more minute. Like, I feel like my kids say that to me constantly, right? Or I'm saying that to them. That's the thing that's so common. And yet you have this moment where they, you know, as you said, they actually have a moment together where they all know what they mean to one another. And yet they have this foresight to know that it's fleeting and that what that moment means. And it on rewatch, it ties so beautifully to sort of that final message of the show about trying to live in the now. And so it's kind of remarkable hearing about how that developed, because on rewatch thematically, it's really beautiful.
That's partially why the line is phrased that way. And we had actually had conversations about this, which is that, you know, one more minute, like you say, is weirdly a phrase that seems to take for granted that there are minutes more to have, you know, like, just give me one more minute. You know, we're not in a rush. You know, I'll be right there. Whereas yeah. one minute more always felt like a longing and a wish. If only I had one minute
exactly.
more, what could I have done with that? Right. So that's why the more sort of those two words end up transposed in the title, because it's really an expression for and a wish for more time that you just don't have.
But not on Chris, Hulu.
That was the thing. It's so funny is the word order. The episode title is incorrect on Hulu, and it's one more minute.
I felt this
like rage, and my husband's like, it's like one word order. I'm like, no, but that's not what it means. Like,
how about the fact that the show picture, the picture they show when you click on it, is Olivia getting into the witness suit.
It's infuriating. There's so many spoilers on their screen caps.
I know.
We're jumping around a little bit, but Brooke, I just want to pick up. It sounded like you were a little bit surprised that the people thought that this Matthew Cole and Hannah romance wouldn't hit. Did you have sort of any thoughts just sort of as you read it and as you were filming that? I mean, it's interesting because a lot of it has to be conveyed without dialogue.
Yeah. I mean, it's surprising to me because I'm curious about from what perspective, because I don't know. It's like, you know, I'm an actress and I'm living this life of this woman and I'm from New Zealand. Like, I'm a wild creature myself. I'm very of the earth. Like, I don't wear shoes very often. I'm very, like, Hannah is, I mean, obviously she's so radically different from me, but there's elements of her that feel so close to me. And Patrick is such a cool actor and person, and it was very easy for me to have chemistry with him. I think it's just a casting thing. I think I talked about it last time when we were discussing Daughters. Like, I just feel like everyone was so beautifully picked to kind of match each other like puzzle pieces. And so, I'm curious about, like, from what perspective they thought it wouldn't work.
It was age. I think, you know, he's
but I'm not young. I guess the perception of Hannah is that she is that, I mean, she's probably younger than I am. She comes across because she's been sort of the young female. I don't know.
Well, even with everything she's been through, there's just like such an innocence to her somehow.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the perspective of how much real estate do you have to write a scene or sequence of scenes that make that emotional connection? Normally if you were just telling the story, you could take a season of full episodes to get these characters to a place where the audience believes that they love each other and have that bond. And so the challenge with this was really, you know, when we were looking at it as a script, was like, well, do we need to play full scenes? Is this a montage? If it's a montage, is it a montage with voiceover? Like, what is the best medium through which to evolve their relationship over this course of, let's say, you know, 10 or 15, I mean, right, less than that, probably 10 minutes.
What, minutes? With the two of them? With
probably Matthew just like four or five Hannah, minutes, right?
Less than that.
Yeah.
I mean, like they meet him, he comes out, and then you cut away. And then she gives you a 2-minute letter and you have to fall in love. And so, again, into that, Chris, just because I think, you know, Chris and I are on a show right now where often like you will pitch something like that, and I think what we were very good about on 12 Monkeys was utilizing that time and proving, you know, Sean was also a master at this as well, which is you can tell a tremendous amount of story in a minute and a half. Yeah. You can get two people to fall in love and believe it if you do it right. So, you know, sometimes we'll hear, oh, you can't do that. You can't do that in like 3 minutes. I'm like, yeah, you fucking can. I can show you how to do it. It's absolutely possible. It just requires work. And I think that is a testament to what you're saying, Chris, is that it's not hard, but it can totally work.
Yeah, particularly when you're using, if you were to have laid this out over the course of, let's say, 3 episodes where you have scenes and dialogue between Matthew and Hannah, and we as the audience have to glean what are they feeling from, you know, looks or things that they're saying. But when you use a voiceover and it has this perspective of Hannah looking back at what attracted to her to this man, how he reminded her of Cole, what was good about him, and what they had in common, then that, it, you know, elegantly cuts through as opposed to if the audience were having to try and figure out what they're feeling for one another over the course of many scenes. So we're in Hannah's point of view, but that point of view is also looking back on that time with someone that she loved. So I think that's one of the reasons also why it, at least for me, I believed it, that it worked right. So well.
I feel like so much of the work is done in the setting up of the mythology too. Like, we're waiting for that moment, right? We want to know who this person is, who the mother is. And I mean, that's such a present question all the time. And we've seen Matthew kind of threaded through. And so we're waiting for that puzzle piece. And I think a lot of the work, the emotional work has been done from the beginning. And so this payoff is just like clicking something into place. And I think, you know, it's interesting because Hannah up until this point doesn't have a ton of screen time, which sounds like such a jerky actress thing to say, but I don't mean it like that. I just think it's really cool how the episode was able to land this emotional payoff. And I do think a lot of that is because of the charting of the mythology and the emotional work that had already been set up right from the very beginning. It's already in our DNA with this show. When we're watching it, it's like you can't separate it because it's so present. It's in the blood of the show. And so, like, I think I talked about this during Daughters a little bit, but as an actress, that's a gift because you don't have that work's been done for you. And I think that's so clever and something I love about this show. And I think that's also part of the reason why people weren't clicking onto the fact that it's Hannah, because they hadn't seen her as much. And it's such, like, to me, an unconventional way of, you know, that a character who you know and you love because she's so in the mythology is suddenly this big puzzle piece. And, you know, everyone thought it was, like a lot of people thought it was Jennifer, and I guess that's because they're so used to seeing her. And so I think it was really clever that Hannah was kind of threaded through, and it wasn't overblown in any way. And I think that's part of the reason why people didn't click onto it, because it's a subtlety.
Especially because she already had such a big part in the mythology. You know, it seemed like her part had kind of been served by being the daughter that Jones was risking the world for.
Yes.
I was just going to say quickly that the other fun thing about that sequence, and Terry, I don't remember when we decided to do this, because it's clearly planted, you know, in a lot of these earlier episodes. Another fun thing just about that sequence was you get to pay off the Jones family monologue, or the Jones family motto, and you get to see how that comes full circle.
Started with Elliot.
That was great. She says the thing her father always said to him, and that's what he says to, you know, his son, and like it, and we decided that early on, but I do feel like doing that and that moment connects Hannah to Cole, even though they're not in the same scene, and technically Cole doesn't even really exist yet or hasn't been born, but it's just the tying together of these two families, I think helps advance and accelerate that emotional connection in that scene as well, in addition to the performance and the letter and all of that.
Yeah, and also just it's something that's so fundamental to Cole, like the character, right? He's never going to give up. So the idea that not only, you know, as we'll get to, you guys heartbreakingly include that Hannah has been there for many moments in his life where he didn't realize it, but the idea that this core principle that goes to like the center of who he is came from her through his father. Mm-hmm. It is really beautiful. I think one of the other really interesting pieces in this montage is, you know, Hannah sees the letter, knows that he's Matthew Cole, and then she talks about this idea of, for the first time in her life, it felt like something was fated, that this felt like fate. And again, that's something that a lot of us in everyday life, when we talk about important moments in our lives or important people in our lives, we kind of toss that around a lot like it was fate. But in this case, because of the craziness of time travel, she already can well suspect what the result of becoming romantically involved with Matthew Cole is going to be. And then it's this, like so many things in this show, it's this very strange conundrum that you have sort of in a time travel show where something is fated because you know it's going to happen, and yet it's still a choice in that moment, right? When she decides to kiss him back. So it's just a very interesting, Hannah has agency in that moment, and yet she also has this foresight that, you know, it's likely going to result in Cole. If we could jump back, just to pick up a little bit on sort of the rest of Hannah's story, if we could go back to that scene with Cole and Cassie back at the Emerson Hotel, they first find her. One of the things you're so surprised to see here on first watch, but when you go back and rewatch it, there's this layer of sort of this tragic layer to that scene, because am I thinking about this the right way? Hannah has already sat down with Cole, right? Yes. And so she knows what she's going to do. She also knows that they've had this moment where they all know what they mean to one another. And yet she has to sit there and sort of absorb, you know, Cole, I think, you know, understandably, he sounds a little bitter. Like he's hearing about his mother and he's like, you know, throwing back the scotch and like, yeah, well, she left me, right? Like she was never there for me. And his mother is right there and knowing that she's about to give up her life for him. And that stillness, Brooke, you were talking about, it's just really, it's striking how much she absorbs and doesn't react and doesn't say what I'm sure she would like to say in that moment, because she can't, because of causality and all of it. I didn't know if you had any sort of thoughts about, there's a lot of layers to play there that don't reveal themselves until after we've seen the end of the episode.
Yeah. I can't even imagine how painful that would be. Like, but I think the thing about Hannah is that she makes peace. I think, you know, that's still like, that would be so hard to hear your child saying both things and to know. I think no matter how much you've prepared yourself for it, and it would be incredibly painful. But I do think she's found a certain type of peace. That's my perspective anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to know in that scene and to know in that moment that despite all of the frustration that Cole is communicating and and feeling that he will ultimately, because she's had the scene already that we'll see at the end of the episode, that he will come to understand and know, and that this won't end without there being a reconciliation between the two of them, one which has happened for Hannah at this point in the story, but has yet to happen for Cole. But I think the knowledge that Cole will get there, and they will have, and yet already have had this moment. Thank you, time travel. helps her approach that moment, and like Brooke just said, have a sense of peace that this is hard for him now, but in a day and several hours, however long later, he will understand. And so she's already weirdly had her goodbye with Cole, in a strange sense, even though she's about to have the final goodbye a few scenes later.
Right.
It was funny when we were shooting all those scenes, because David, who was directing, he kept saying to me, hey, can you sometimes look at Amanda? Because you're just like really fixed on Aaron. And I was like, yeah, because I only want to look at Aaron because, like, you know, I'm just soaking it all in. And he was like, cool. It's just like sometimes I need you to look at it. It's like, you know, we don't want it to be like creepy. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. But, you know, it would be so such a crazy thing to see your son going. I mean, not that it, you know, just to know that this is it.
Yeah. Anyway. And also she gave, if you think about Hannah's perspective, she had a baby like 8, 9 years ago, has watched her Cole as a child from a distance, has met with him as an adult, and now is seeing him as an adult again. It's, you know, these crazy time travel things that it can only happen in this kind of story. So there's an additional kind of mind, like what would be going on in your head when you know that your son is a child over here, but in front of you, he's an adult, you know?
How crazy.
Yeah. Terry and Chris, it's so interesting that you guys added that final scene because with the Jones family, because one of sort of the layers of tragedy to the Jones family is that as just like Hannah was actually alive and with the daughters and Jones never knew, Hannah is there, and are we interpreting this correctly? When we were watching the season one episode Paradox, when Matthew Cole died and Cole found Ramsey at the home, that Hannah was there and observing it, which is such an unbelievable layer on rewatch, but also just thematically to think all this time he thought his mother had abandoned him and she was always there, right? But just was there for him in the only way that she could. Was there a different way that you were going to incorporate that, or was that just sort of something that
was in the script? We were going to see it. We were going to cut to her out there watching as the snow starts to come down because there's flurries in that scene, and we just didn't have the time and the resources to go do that because we were already stretched so thin. But yeah, it was in the script, wasn't it, Chris?
We'd always envisioned that we would have these little pops and flashes of her in those pivotal moments, looking on, but just because of the time and the production realities, we were never able to do them.
Also, and there's like a creep element too. There's always like there's this peeping Tom always like hanging out, and it's Hannah in the shadows. You know what I mean? Like, you want to protect Hannah too. I remember vividly. I can dig up the script. I'm pretty sure that there were pops of her throughout the series in the background.
Right. And it's particularly crazy because that's the episode where Jones decides to go through with her pregnancy and Hannah's standing off to the side when her mother's making right. that decision. Makes your head hurt. So one of the other sort of devastating gut punches, and I think it is really important for where you are taking Cassie in the finale, is that you put the character of Cassie in the position of she's a doctor who is supposed to do no harm. And now you're asking that character to drop the calivirus on the world. So just wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about sort of your thinking and putting the character in that position and sort of kind of then what flowed from that and focusing in the episode.
Well, I mean, it's, you're just supporting that last moment on the balcony. You know, you're putting Cassie through the ringer. You're like, that's the worst thing she could do. Is be the one for years, the thing that she's tried to stop and will try to continue to stop as she, you know, continues her loop, is her, that she did it, that she was the one who dropped the vial, and breaking her. And then she does that and then comes home to find out, yeah, not only did you do that, we're going to have to completely erase the man you love. And we're like, it's, you wanted to earn the moment of doubt on that balcony when it's like, okay, we're free and clear, turn the machine off, no Red Forest. That if you hadn't earned Cassie's journey to that point, you would just hate her. You'd be like, turn it the fuck off. What the fuck are you doing? You know, you'd be yelling at the screen, which mm-hmm. was such a danger at that moment in the finale. What you wanted to get there when you got to that moment, you wanted to feel, oh, of course she's gonna have, oh of course, why didn't I see that coming? She's not gonna want to turn it off. So that was, I think, structurally, from a character perspective, what we were building towards. Chris, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, and weirdly, I think that we had built these little moments in consciously or unconsciously. You know, I look back at like 402, right? You know, where she is listening to the version of herself who says that, you know, Cassie, sometimes a loop is just a second chance. And that weirdly is a Cassie, a version of herself that is trying to convince her that the thing that she knows she's going to have to do, the hardest thing in the world, drop that vial and do the harm, will ultimately be the foundation of their second chance to earn their victory. You know, so that, like, whether she's known it or not, she's been struggling with these questions throughout the entire season. And then she's faced with it here. And as she's watching this incredible moment of grief play out between Cole and Hannah, begins to realize that I have to give this moment, this tragedy, a purpose, and see it through so that it didn't happen for nothing. And then just sort of out of all of her sadness and pain, dropping that vial almost isn't so much choice as a resignation to this is what has to happen. And I hope that it happening produces the result that I want it to have. But it's a dice roll. It's a gamble. It's just one made, I think, in sort of utter despair.
Yeah, it's I feel like as you watch it, just because the way the camera spins around and the score, I feel like you're just holding your breath the whole time, and yet you know what's coming, if that makes sense. Yeah, it's really, it's just, can you talk to us about, because one of the things that I think is so interesting in that scene leading up to it is, you know, the pallid man has been such a creepy looming figure for four seasons. And yet when he's talking to Cassie in that moment, the editing shows us, you flash back to when the pallid man lost his parents because of our heroes, right? Because of Agent Gale and because of Cassie. And it flips sort of the point of view when he's talking about loss. I at least have this like moment of empathy for the pallid man, which is a very strange place to be as a viewer. But it's so interesting that you give them sort of that moment that they almost understand one another because of their mutual loss, even though that loss has been really at the hands of each other, if that makes sense.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it had, you know, we had already killed him. So you're in his timeline, he's eventually going to be killed by Olivia. So, and it's his last moment, you know, it's the last time you're going to see the pallid man. And it just felt like, again, all also in service of Cassie, which is, you know, what pallid man's father was saying to her was dug in. I mean, it's the words you hear right before he appears, was that this is really having a tremendous impact on Cassie's decision about where she's going to go in Titan.
Yeah.
And the other thing I like about that scene, there were versions of this script where I think pallid man spoke a lot more. And I think we absolutely made the right decision to make this as sort of brief and to the point as possible. But there is something I like about the suggestion here that Pallid Man shares Cassie's frustration at sort of being subject to the whims of time, right? Like that when he says, you know, you may yet still win if you choose to, I always thought that line, and the one thing it's a little bit of like an agent of chaos, right? Like he is in some ways saying, you know, time has fucked with me, and my associations and my obligations may have put me on this particular side, but I don't really care who wins. I'm very curious to see, you know, that there is something oddly encouraging about him in that moment that allows you access to that empathy that you're talking about. That is, oh yeah, this has taken a toll on him in deeply personal ways as well. So I think it just gives him this added layer of depth as he walks off into the airport that I always thought was really cool.
Yeah, it is a great farewell. The airport scene, am I right in thinking in some ways it's an homage to the film 12 Monkeys, which sort of has its big conclusion at airport? Yeah, sure. Okay. Definitely. So, yeah. And is that why you guys chose to sort of have this big, I mean, obviously it makes sense sort of if you wanted to spread a virus to drop it in an airport. But I think it's so interesting what you guys are playing with, because the film 12 Monkeys sort of suggests that you can't change anything. Whereas your story, it's a very different kind of time travel story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it was always intentional.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And again, it was the thing, I think, when people saw the pilot, you know, if you were a hardcore fan of the movie, they're like, they don't get it. They don't get the whole point of the movie was that you can't change time. I'm like, I got it. Yes, I love the movie too. It's four seasons of television, you know, four seasons of television without changing time. I don't know if that's the best choice. So, yeah.
I also think just for us, kind of as we were looking at the end and we were walking out the door, you know, we had come so far from that pilot that was an adaptation of that movie, you know, that we've come so far away from the notions and ideas presented in the film. I mean, I think you can say that season one of this show is a fair adaptation of the original film and deals with a lot of the same themes and textures and, you know, the pandemic and the espionage and the can they change this and all of that. But by the time you get to 2 and 3 and 4, you know, we've become, I think, such our own beast that it felt appropriate and nice to, as we raced into our finale, give that sort of nod back to the thing that allowed us all to be doing this for, you know, as long as we did it for 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And we just wanted to tip our hat to that one more time.
Yeah. I mean, but as a viewer, you come away with a very different, just thematically, the message that you carry away from the film is like, well, I guess nothing matters, you know, whereas your show, sort of thematically, it's a lot more positive, right? It's if people don't give up, that maybe they can make a difference, right? So, right. Yeah. One listener had a really great observation, and maybe this is more a question for the director, but Brooke, you were that sort of final image that we have of Cole holding Hannah, who has sacrificed herself, not only for her son, but like for the greater good. It is a reverse of, you know, like the pietà, right? Of like a mother holding her son that sacrificed. Was that something that was just sort of happenstance, or was that something you all talked about just sort of in staging that scene?
I think it's happenstance, but it also just is innately in what it is. You know, she's the mother and she's been cradled by the son that she didn't get to raise. I mean, we didn't deliberately plan it out like this is going to be a visual image that speaks to another image, but it's just by nature of those two characters being together in that moment, it just is what it is.
Yeah.
He's holding her in a way that she wished she could have done for him, like, you know, been there for him. So, it wasn't super deliberate, but also it just within the fibers of what it is.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I saw that comment on Twitter a couple days ago or weeks ago or however long it was.
Yeah.
And part of me wanted to just be like, oh yeah, no, of course, that was completely intentional.
But you're absolutely referencing Michelangelo.
It never was, but it actually did make me mindful of how, in a weird way, how the fact that you can see that similarity and that the similarity was unintentional. I actually think makes me think about the Pietà and the universality of what that says. You know, the sacrifice that parents will make for children and the debt the children owe to their parents. That we did it even unconsciously, or that idea of what that piece of art symbolizes is just a universal idea is actually quite beautiful and quite moving. And so, you know, it certainly wasn't planned, but I'm happy for the comparison.
Yeah, it even ties back image, like just imagery wise to the end of Paradox, right, when Cole paradoxes himself. So yeah, that all, you know, it's all just baked into like our consciousness, right? But yeah, I didn't want to forget to ask, Cole and Terry, one of the really fun things about this episode is that you bring us back to the night room. although it's very, which was such a phenomenal episode in season one. And if you go back, I actually went back and watched sort of some of those night room scenes. And it's actually pretty hilarious the way, you know, in the first episode in season one, Cole is like, as Cassie calls him, Johnny Nightroom, just like, you know, heading in there. But in this one, he's actually sitting and being like, this seems too easy. And you're like, wow, Cole's really had some character growth in terms of how he goes in. But did you have sort of any thoughts about bringing the story back to sort of that, you know, back to Markridge, back to the Nightroom, and that there was still a vial left there?
Well, it's not the exact same Nightroom, because by then it's destroyed. Mm-hmm. I believe it's a secondary location, right? It's not the same night room that they.
I think we had debated back and forth about whether it should be the original night room and whether we could.
Oh no, they're in the facility. They're not in the night room. They're in the Markridge facility from the pilot.
Yeah,
where they find in cold storage the vials. Yeah, but they're not in the actual night room now.
And I don't think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Terry, I don't think that was necessarily, we had that thought. I think it was just the production realities of recreating the night room, because we had talked about whether they should be moving through those same corridors and whether you should see, you know, remnants of that episode. And I think this just felt more right for this.
Well, it also made it episode what we could do. Right. Well, you also didn't want to nullify the night room episode. You still wanted.
Right.
I mean, that was a success. They did burn the thing, so you didn't want to be like, "Oh, they didn't do it right."
Right.
So it was just another Markridge facility. But what the spirit of going back into season one, we were very, very conscious of, and trying to make that feel like a little bit of a season one Cole and Cassie, like moving, you know, on the hunt for the plague. Feeling again. Yeah. Boy, that was a hard episode to cut. What a hard episode to post.
Well, so can you tell us a little bit more about the post of this episode?
Yeah, you know, this is where, again, the contributions of Drew and Stephen Barton in this episode are like, they're as big as any other artist on the show. I mean, for Steven, it's obvious. I mean, just listen to it. That score drives in the last act, and hits that emotional punch and just does so much throughout the whole thing. That poor guy had to sit with me Chris will tell you, for hours and hours. I'm like, no, now we need percussion. We need these things. And like, it's just outstanding what he was able to do and the sound he's able to produce on that show. As far as cutting it goes, I wasn't there, so you know, I spent quite a bit of time on set for like little moments that were important, you know, and I was not there for very much of this episode, which was hard because it was Brooke's last episode and I wanted to be, but I was prepping the finale and it was crazy. We were driving all over Toronto to figure it out. So, you know, tonally, and then Chris couldn't be there for all of it too, because Chris was assisting. I'd be like, Chris, we've got some real heavy stuff coming up in the finale. I need help writing. And he's like, all right, let me dig in. Let's think about it. So so you had Kristen on set, who is a fantastic executive producer, but tonally in my mind, this had to be kind of a very intense episode, very, very morose. And I remember I walked on set. So if you remember the episode well, Jennifer gets the wheelchair for Jones, right? Jones is really on her last legs and is dying, right? She's barely, is she going to make it to the finale? And Jennifer's like, I'll be here. I will push you until the end. I will, you know, and it's this emotional moment where, you know, like we're now just putting Jones in a wheelchair. I came onto set and in the scene where they go to finally crack the code, to crack the primary code, Emily Hampshire speeds in Jones like a race car and then lands, and then Jones goes, all right, we need to find the end. And I'm like, whoa, no, I don't think now's the time for a big Jennifer silly joke right now. And everyone on set fucking hated me because they all thought it was really, really funny. But all I was seeing in the cut was this moment that you just was like so beautiful. And then it was just completely tanked by silliness. And so that was the kind of thing where, you know, you have a thing in your head and a tone and that you're trying to protect, but you have to realize not everybody knows that. Not everybody knows what you hope the final product is going to be. And so and just because it was so ambitious, when that first cut came in, it was long. You didn't feel the connection. You didn't really, in my opinion, feel like Marion Woods, that Emma really was it. Like I was just still doubting it. So we went in and I was like, Drew, we got to get really psychological here. We got to build connections that don't exist. Like we have to cut from Emma's face to Cole's face, like just subconsciously hit the audience with that's mom, that's mom, that's mom. So that by the time you turn the card at the end, it really is a surprise. And then just the pace. And then, you know, sometimes you're not there for choreography. And like in some of the pivotal scenes, scenes that are very angsty, like, Hannah talking to Cole and telling him this story, but not telling him the truth. And he's finally hearing about his mom. Well, I wasn't there, but I think there was a choice that Cole would just be sitting on the couch drinking a scotch. And that felt like the least angsty, like that's not really what I would be doing if I was like, you know, about to find out the truth about my mom. I think I'm pacing. I think I'm all fucked up. So there was just creative differences that we had to like wade through. Then the fact to build the reveal, you know, that you felt like you were didn't to make sure the episode had drive at the end, that you were building towards this big answer. You were finally going to crack what this code meant at this exact moment that Hannah reveals herself and kills herself. That's hard to do. There's literally two things happening in that moment. Is Cole is the djinn, Hannah is mom. Two bombshells, not one. And you're not really supposed to do that. I can't think of, you know, Darth Vader is your father. That's it. That's pretty much like, that's big enough. You don't need to be like, and Luke is going to destroy the universe. You know, you don't need that one too. So, you know, I think we lucked out. I think we managed to get it to work, but we were lucky because it was way too ambitious an episode.
Terry, whose decision was it? Because one of my favorite post-editing grace notes of the entire season and series is in this episode, because when I had written it, I never thought to put it into the script to do it, and you guys did it. I told you if you gave me yellow, I'd paint you the world.
Oh, and then you come back to it?
Cutting to the season.
Oh, That was
you, yeah.
Yeah, because you wanted, if you knew the line, it was really cool. But if you saw the line, then you were a genius. And I just wanted to feel like we were geniuses.
Well, also, all of those season one, there's a lot of cutting back, right? We see Jennifer from the second episode. We see the pallid man sort of cackling crazily in the night room, right? Mm-hmm. So all of that also, I, at least when I'm watching it, you know, that third gut punch that it was them, you know, this dilemma that was driving the whole thing of how are we going to save the 7 billion people? And it takes you back to when, as a viewer, you were really focused on that problem in season one, whereas there's been a lot of other things that you've been focused on as a viewer in seasons 2, 3, and 4. It also sort of underscores that, you know, it's temporary because it's going to be reset, but it is tragic that our heroes that were at great cost trying to prevent this plague were the ones that actually started it.
Right.
I would love to hear, just sort of as we sort of close out, one of the most, I think, beautiful pieces of writing in the whole show, and also the way Brooke reads it. I don't know, Brooke, maybe you should be doing like audio tapes for books.
I wish. I would love to.
Is Hannah's letter to Cole. And Chris, did you write that, or was it sort of like a team effort? We would just love to hear a little bit more about that. Lines like, I was proud to be a daughter, and the double meaning there, as both Hannah's daughter, but also a member of the daughters. We're proudest to be your mother. I will tell you that as a mother, pretty much made me sob uncontrollably. So I would just love to, thank you, question mark. but I'd love to hear more about how you all put that together, because it is just this beautiful writing.
Yeah, I worked very closely with Kristen on this episode. One of the things that I had worked on, I think, in, oh God, what was it, Enemy? When Hannah has that moment with Jones about, you know, seeing your parents through to the end, and walking them the rest of the way. You know, that Kristen early on had said that sort of, that sentiment between those two characters was the kind of tone and tenor that should drive the letter. So while Kristen was off breaking the nuances of how, you know, the episode at large would play out, I went off to start working on this letter and the sequence and focusing a lot on that one piece of that one act. And just trying to get the moves of it right and express, and like Terry said, create a relationship in that time, not just between Hannah and Matthew Cole, but Hannah and Cole, like as revealing herself as his mother. And so, and that scene gave us a lot of gifts too, that we weren't initially expecting to give ourselves. I mean, I remember just sort of in the course of writing, you don't think about these things a lot. You know, you just put your fingers on the keyboard and you just see what kind of flows out of you and what comes and hope that your subconscious has the wheel. And Matthew Cole putting the engagement ring on the car gave us the gift, I think, because I like ran into Terry's office and was like, oh my God, this needs to be the ring he gives to Cassie in the next episode. And it gave us that gift, and it obviously gave us the gift of Brooke's performance, and just going back to the sentiment of what parents do for their children. I mean, this is a show about family in a lot of ways, in many, many ways actually. And so yeah, it was one of the more, it was one of those pieces of writing in the show, and it happened a few times where you just trust that you trust that we've done what we needed to do, and you sort of put your fingers on the laptop keyboard, and then you just let something else take over and be confident that you'll get to the place you want to get. And that's what writing the sequence felt like. But knowing that everybody and all the, knowing that we'd done the work, knowing that we had the right actors to do it, knowing that we had Steven and Drew and Post who would nail it, knowing that we would have Terry who would come in and sort of put all the brushstrokes together in the right way. So it was really one of my favorite moments on the show, and one of the moments I'm most proud of. And then to be able to contribute that to Kristen's episode, which was already, I think, in itself really terrific and breathless and well-paced and emotional and nuanced, was a gift for me. So.
And Brooke, I imagine you recorded that sort of in a vacuum, and then And it's sort of the performance is just in your voice. And then you watch it all be put together sort of when the first time you watch this episode and you have your voiceover and then you have the pieces of your performance and sort of watching the culmination of Hannah's story. Do you have any thoughts about sort of this last piece of Hannah's journey?
Yeah, I recorded that. I think it was my very last thing I did on the show. It was like in the hallway. Just before I was about to wrap, it was super late at night or early in the morning, maybe. And I think, you know, so much of the emotional work is in the text. So I just wanted it to be very, very simple. But it's funny for me to talk about watching it because some actors really like watching themselves and some don't. And I'm such a jerky, egocentric actress that, like, I find it very hard to separate myself from stuff when I watch it, and I find it very hard to watch myself. So the first time I saw it, I was more seeing me. And it was really interesting to watch it again and see the story. And so I was able to be a lot more moved by it once I sort of removed myself from it. But I do remember watching the finale, the scene where Cole gives the same ring to Cassie, and I think that's when it really hit me, like the culmination of the whole story, because it still felt like Hannah was part of that. And it really, really, I think because I wasn't in that scene, and obviously I'd read the finale and I knew what was going to happen, but it just got me. And when I watched it, I was in my flat, and one of my flatmates, I think roommates, we called him here, I didn't know she was home, and I was crying, like I was wailing, really, really crying, because I thought no one was home. And she knocked on the door, and I was like, hi. And then she came in, she was like, you're okay? And I was like, sorry, I'm fine, I'm just watching 12 Monkeys. And she was like, aren't you in that show? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, and you're still crying like this? And I was like, it's so sad. And she was like, but didn't you know what was going to happen? And I was like, yeah, I just didn't expect it to get me. Like, I had to like send a selfie to Amanda. I was like, oh, this is so beautiful. I'm so sad. I was crying. She was like, I'm glad that it was moving to you, but don't cry too hard. But it just, I think, like, yeah, because I wasn't in it, I was able to remove my ego from it and really feel the impact of that whole story of the family and be like, I don't know, I just felt so proud of myself. Just so, sounds ridiculous, but it really landed for me in that
moment. Yeah, no, in your defense, it is perhaps the saddest proposal in the history of the world.
Oh my God, it's so sad.
And that ring is a huge part of it, right? It's just,
yeah.
That ring is constant disappointment. For both Matthew and Cole, and
and just the ring, the fact that it's a ring, I mean, it you know, obviously symbolically it means so much, but also the circle, it all just clicked in and I was a mess.
I will say just a piece of this, because it sort of, these random thoughts will occur to you at random times. I don't know if it hit me during post, or if it was something I had turned to Terry and said, or maybe Terry had said it to me, I'm not quite sure. But there's a refrigerator logic issue in this that now when I watch the scene, I can't help but think about, and it makes me laugh, which is, if you think about it, the scene implies where Cole finds the letter implies that Hannah went back to the very same hotel in which she had basically just murdered a guy and hung out in her old room for the rest of her livelong day. And if Cole and Cassie had just thought to sweep the fucking Emerson in the future, they would have come across this note. Like, if they were just like, we're going to check out every room, this whole would have been gangbusters. The show would have been over days or weeks or months before for them. Hopefully at that point, you're not thinking about any of that. But
when do they have time to do that, though?
Oh, I don't
sweep the Emerson.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the housekeeping sucks. The tab can is still there from the 1970s. So clearly, there's going to get like a 1-star review on housekeeping.
Right. I'm just imagining an evening in the Emerson where like a drunk Cole is like, fuck it, I'm going to look at all these other, I'm going to eavesdrop in some of these other rooms, and comes across an envelope that's like, holy shit, she's my mom. Great.
Well, thank you guys so much. I mean, Chris and Brooke, I think this is our last time talking to you all. Terry's going to come back and do the finale.
Well, that's very
so
sad.
Much
but
for
I,
having
I,
me. It's been really
yeah,
lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that I is didn't until know. The rewatch podcast. Third time's the charm.
I mean, we would get more things right because I think we've sorted things out on the way. So yeah, maybe we could get all these loops right. But I just want to give Brooke, if you had sort of any other closing thoughts on playing this character or being part of telling this story.
I just feel really lucky that I was able to, and like it's so cool and random to have been picked to be able to do this because I was in LA testing for something else that I didn't get, and I was only here, I was only meant to be here for 2 days, and I extended it a week, and in that week was when I did the audition. So it was just completely crazy that I was here in LA from New Zealand and that happened, and then, you know, crazy to get a job, but then also incredible that it was this job and getting to tell this story and experience creating this life of this really complex, beautiful person. And but I'm very, very grateful. And yeah, it's something that's always going to be very special to me.
And if I can just sort of second that back to you, Brooke, that it was an honor and a privilege to write for you and have you say these words and do these actions so magnificently and lovely and beautifully as you did. I really deeply appreciate that. And then also to you guys, just for since this is my last time on the podcast, just thank you for doing this. And thank you to the fans for watching and listening. And it's something that's deeply meaningful and very special to have created something that resonates with people past that first viewing. And I feel like as much as I've always felt like the actors and crew and, you know, especially, you know, Terry, who's just a dear, dear friend of mine, but everybody involved with 12 Monkeys has in some way feels like family to me, to know that there's also an audience out there who is as devoted to this as we are, and they feel like family as well. And so to have you guys have taken the effort to do all this, I really appreciate it as well.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you guys for being so generous with your time and coming out and talking. And you know, I think for the audience, this is an episode, you know, you all broke our hearts and then sort of put them back together. And it's not a common viewing experience. There's a reason why people say 1 minute more with sort of that reverence. So thank you. Just as we close out, Terry and Chris, do you guys have any update for folks on Picard or sort of what the heck's happening in Hollywood?
We are legally not allowed to say a single thing other than we continue to work on it, and we're in the room daily and working on it, and we're really happy with what we're coming up with. But that's probably about all I can say, and even that, I'm not sure. CBS might be like, you cannot say the word Picard. I don't know. It gets, but yeah, no, we're working away. It's a strange time. We don't know when we would shoot again, but then no one in Hollywood has figured that out yet. It's just an extraordinary time where we gotta wait and see. But I sure hope chuckleheads like fucking Michigan and Huntington Beach, I don't mind. Come at me, fight me. You know, get inside. Let's bring this curve down. Science is real, you know?
Yeah. Do you guys have anything as we close out, since everyone's stuck at home, that you have read or watched that you could recommend?
Oh, if anyone likes reading plays, I read a play a couple of weeks ago called Little Light by Alice Birch, and it's exquisite. It's glorious. So if you like reading plays, it's a good one to order.
Yeah, that was Little Light.
Little Light, yeah.
Alice Birch. Cool.
Well, I continue to sing the praises of Dispatches from Elsewhere, which I think is a really overlooked and really beautiful and interesting, fascinating show on AMC. And I will say this, just, and it's completely unrelated to genre at all, but I've really enjoyed the show Dave on FX, the Little Dickies half hour comedy. I think really started off as a kind of Louis Curb Your Enthusiasm, kind of very raunchy, funny few episodes, but it pivots into these moments of like really genuine, lovely character work. And it's really funny and really crass and really moving and really dramatic all at once. And it's that wrapped up this week. And I love the finale. And, you know, also Netflix. I've reached the end of Netflix. So all of Netflix is great.
How about you, Terry?
You know, for years, Chris has been trying to get me to watch Peaky Blinders on Netflix. And it's just always ended up, for whatever reason, at the bottom of the list. And so I just binged through 5 seasons of that, and it's outstanding. I'm obsessed with it. I know more about 1920s razor gangs in Birmingham, England, than I ever should. Now, because I've gone deep dive. I mean, I've gone on the Reddit now. Like, I'm into like theories and things. It's a phenomenal show. You should all watch it. Might be a little hard for you, Tina, because I know that, you know, you like your shows where everybody hugs at the end of the episode. And the camera,
but... Right. That's why I did a podcast about this show. Right. I don't know. I'm watching The Crown, and there's not a lot of hugging going on. So,
oh, so did you get to that episode yet? The school episode that I've been talking about?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, it was
so good
with Prince Charles and Prince Philip and the wounds parents inflict on their children. Yeah, it was rough.
But it's also about him and his sister too. Yeah. He never got over his sister. It's I'm convinced that show is. Has more character depth than the real people it's portraying. It's did you watch that, Chris?
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, I think
that, you know, the episode, I think that, the Matt Smith
that episode. I think the and then in season 3, I think the Aberforth coal mining episode and moon landing episode are amazing pieces of writing, and just it manages to find these moments in history and then asks itself the question like, emotionally, what is the counterpart, not just to what is going on in history, what's the emotional counterpart to what's going on in its characters? And it almost always finds the right relationship between the historical context and the inner emotional context, and every piece, even though it's such a it just feels so complete. It's so good. I love it.
Have you seen it, bro? You've seen it, right? Yeah. We've talked about
it. I love The Crown. Yeah.
There was Brooke, the last time you were on, we were talking about sort of female characters on TV, and the episode Dear Mrs. Kennedy, I felt like took very, very familiar historical events and framed it to be about women and what we compare ourselves to and the way we're pitted against each other, but how we can also become complicit in that. I thought it was really wonderful from that and I did not expect to come out of an episode about, you know, the JFK assassination. We've seen a lot. And I just thought it was a really different take, kind of digging into all of those things we sort of deal with as women. It was really good.
And internalized misogyny that's inherent in everything, and it's like drips from that culture. So
just watching Elizabeth II try to fit into a dress that she's wearing to impress another woman. And I was like, man, that is such a moment we've all done.
So good.
All right, guys, thank you so much. I'm Brooke and Chris. We're sad to say goodbye, but we really appreciate the time that you spent with us. We know our listeners do as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Terry, you'll be back to break down, you know, TV's greatest series finale.
Sure. we can talk about the Shield.
All right, everybody.
Thank
Stay
you.
Stay safe. Thanks again.
All right, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you guys for listening. What an awesome treat. Thank you so much to Terry, Chris, and Brooke. It has been a pleasure. We have a special episode coming up next that will include Terry, as well as Drew Nichols, editor, and Stephen Barton, composer. It will be specifically about the music from the series. So look forward to that coming out. And as always, until next time, we'll see you soon.